Welcome to the Aligned Musician Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kimberly Hankins, and I'm a violist as well as a yoga and breathwork facilitator. I created this podcast to empower musicians like you to find your own path towards healing and normalize conversations around musicians' wellness. I'm so grateful for your support and thank you for joining me. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode. I'm really excited to share with you this interview I had with my dear friend, Chino Saburano. He's a violinist and a doctoral candidate and an international student. Being an international student has its own challenges, and these challenges can absolutely affect our mental and physical well-being. I just want to share that there is a trigger warning for this episode. We talked about racial trauma, generational trauma, and injustice. I know that I learned so much in this conversation with Chino, and I think it's really important for those of us who are teachers to understand that international students have a lot on their plate and that there are tangible things that we can do to offer them support. Often international students can feel like their voices aren't being heard. And so I'm grateful that I have the ability to provide this platform, and especially for Chino for being so vulnerable and willing to share his experience. If you'd like to continue the conversation after this episode, you can check out Chino's Instagram, which is at Chino Orchestra. I know that Chino is currently in the process of updating his website, but as soon as it's published, I'll add it to the show notes so you have a way of learning more information about him and his work. We recorded this episode on Instagram Live last week, and I'm so excited to finally share this with you.
I'm Chino. I am a DMA doctoral candidate from ASU. And I've been playing the violin for 21, 22 years and counting. I am from the Philippines, grew up there and lived there for a long time before I moved to the States in 2015 to take my master's in Western Illinois University. And I'm here for my DMA program. And I got to meet Kim through Herberger String Quartet, which is the graduate string fellowship quartet. It was a lot of fun and a lot of tears. Some of it.
Really?
Really, it's like what Michael said is like we had a double master's.
Yeah.
The amount of chamber repertoire, coachings, performances felt like we did another degree.
It really does feel that way. And I'm so grateful for that experience because I feel like it really helped me learn how to play chamber music, which I mean, I had done, but I had never really had the opportunity to dive in deep and take it really seriously in a string quartet formation. And so, it was really awesome. And Chino and I, we joined the same year as the other two members of the quartet. And I think it was really cool because we were all doctoral students,
yeah.
All kind of in the same place in our life. Mm-hmm. And even though we're very different people, it was really awesome.
We just magically clicked. That was good. What else? I was the co-president of ASU Music, Dance, and Theater School's IDEA student organization, which stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, Accountability Student Committee. And it was a fun learning experience for me. Since being an international student, I wasn't aware of the deeper issues regarding race, gender, and equity in the United States. Back in the Philippines, I know that being racist is bad and of course frowned upon. You shouldn't be a bigot. But then I didn't see firsthand what racism is and what racism does to minorities, most especially to Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Although we have our own kind of racism back home, And I guess in some Asian communities, it's more on the colorism, where darker skinned Asians are discriminated. And I admit I was part of that problem when I was younger because I didn't know better then. But now I learned a lot, grew up a lot, and I know that I'm a better person and will try to continue to learn more. I'm not perfect. Every day it's a learning experience for me. And I just want to acknowledge that I am actively seeking to be a better person and anti-racist and all of that.
That's awesome. I had no idea like how involved that committee was, and yeah, I'd love to hear more about that. Maybe later in our conversation we can circle back.
Absolutely.
But let's dive in. I'm so excited to talk with you, Chino, because like we became really quick friends when we were at ASU, but and we did have some very deep conversations.
Very deep. Yeah.
But I'm excited to like dive into some of the musicians' wellness stuff with you and kind of the intersectionality of some of it and just your own experience. So what is your musicians' wellness journey, or maybe how has being an international student impacted your relationship with music? I know that's like a big, that's a big question.
Yes.
So feel free to like talk as much as you want in it or as little.
I think being an international student while being a musician has a unique set of setbacks and problems that we need to face, because if you are here as an international student, your visa will limit how much you can do outside school. In terms of employment or getting paid, absolutely you can't earn money outside school or outside school employment unless there's authorization. And authorization requires time and money.
Mm-hmm.
So while you're in school, you either get jobs in school, like what I did. I was grateful that I was a TA for 2 years, and now I'm a part-time Starbucks barista in the ASU Starbucks. So that helped me a bit with my finances. But in terms of professional development, which means more performances outside of school, more opportunities in teaching and performing outside academia or outside the walls of your school, is kind of hard to achieve because you need to go through a lot of decision making and rules in order to have those opportunities. And it's quite ironic because you are here to study and being a better musician, and performing is part of our career, which means you need to perform more. And it's quite limiting if you're just performing in school.
Yeah.
So I completely respect the rules because the rules are there for a reason, but it's just limiting because you need to go through a lot of hoops, legal hoops, and time, money, stress. There's also a deadline, because if by the time you're finished with your degree and you didn't do anything for your career development and it's time to go back home, it's like, oh shit, now what do I do? Especially when back home, pre-COVID and most especially now COVID, with COVID in the Philippines, opportunities for classical musicians are quite hard, not quite, really difficult to get by. Faculty positions there are no faculty positions open as far as I know. Orchestras are still shut down. And some of my friends and were musicians sadly went to other venues of earning money, they had to leave their instrument temporarily to be an entrepreneur and all of that stuff, which is kind of sad. Like, I love the violin and I am passionate about music making, and it hurts if I go home with this amount of training and I just don't have anything to do.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing all of that, Chino. Like, I didn't put that together in that way, that like you have to pursue external opportunities as a performer in order to gain validity as a performer so that you can apply for jobs and stay in the US. Like,
yeah. Of course, I want to do it legally, of course.
Yeah, right? I mean, but how frustrating, because it then is. It's like, yeah, it's like, what do you do? How do you create those opportunities for yourself in a way where it's worth your time and your energy, especially if you aren't in a place financially to be able to just not work and like take whatever opportunities come your way and just decide not to get paid for them.
Yeah. So what worked for me right now is a working student where I earn and save up, and that will make me more comfortable in doing personal projects outside the school, but for free, because you couldn't really earn externally, I mean, outside school. So the projects I've been doing right now is offering free master classes to schools and universities. Right now, there are schools and universities in the Philippines that happily took my offer. So I'll be doing that, and more on doing things for free at the moment, just to get your foot in the door. I'm also planning on connecting with my other friends and colleagues here in the US if I could offer free orchestra sectionals for their high school, which I did during my master's, and it was wonderful. Because I was a graduate teaching assistant, and my teacher and other string faculty visit other high schools for giving free master classes and more outreach. So a lot of outreach. While they are free, they are useful for your own development and also for your CV, because employers right now, according to my teacher, they really look for something, for things that you did that are impactful. Local community to the international community, something that you did that you just didn't do out of sheer whim.
Yeah.
I just want to do it because it's I just want to do this concert because I like the music and people liked it. That's it. So I also plan on doing benefit concerts, benefit recitals, because I'm passionate about equity, diversity, racial justice, gender, sexual orientation, equality, and all of that, because I'm gay. Hello. So I'm passionate about giving back to those communities and making sure that I am a musician that is sensitive to the times. I am frustrated that when the murder of George Floyd happened last year, that's the moment where finally a lot of classical music institutions listened. It took another black man's life to finally they realized, oh, maybe we do need to change. And also the pandemic, like it took a pandemic. Anyway, yeah, like classical music institutions, especially orchestras, realized after the pandemic, people aren't going to concert venues because it's unsafe. And also, sad to say, we're not viewed as essential. So it's a lot of soul searching last year.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's hard for musicians to adjust and to figure out their role and how to move forward. And that's something that I've definitely been thinking about too. And I think, I don't know, just something I noticed is that I think a lot of musicians want to put these programs together and they are super excited, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to put together an all African American composer concert or an all female composer concert. And it's like, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like sometimes when those concerts are done from the absolutely best well-meaning intentions, sometimes it comes across as like, wait, why can't these pieces be programmed on other concerts? Like, why do we have to have specific concerts for these nationalities or for these backgrounds when, like, a lot of the music we play because it's great music, you know? And I think that something that I've discovered this year is just like how many underappreciated or undervalued gems of classical music there really are that we just never learned about in school.
Absolutely, absolutely. I did a lot of researching for New Rep last year because I was like, how many performances of Beethoven symphonies do we really need? How many performances, recordings of Beethoven symphonies do we really need by the same orchestra? It's just a different conductor.
Yeah.
I'm not discounting Beethoven's contribution. It's just we're putting them on a pedestal so high. It's quite unreasonable. Y'all should listen to Confocal podcast and Spotify. Let me check who. I'm a big fan because I also learned a lot from that podcast. It's about classical music and its future, hosted by conductor and violinist Daniel Cho. There you go. I learned a lot in that podcast about diversity. I learned that at the end of the day, Bach, Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart, these are people with extraordinary ability. Emphasis on people. At the end of the day, they are people. They are not like absolute mortal beings. And also, on the question of representation in repertoire, I agree that these kinds of repertoire, the underappreciated ones, I guess we shouldn't really put just one concert of all of them grouped together and then drop them and then move on to canon. Yeah, it's a lot of checking the boxes.
Yeah.
In the past. I don't have an answer on how to do it more effectively, but I would say one thing that will help is consistency when in your programming. Like, you don't want to just play an all-women repertoire concert just for one time and then good. I already played women composers. I'm automatically a big anti-misogynist
I'm a feminist now.
Now let's go back to it's consistency and also intention. Like, you are approach these repertoire with the right intention, that you really are interested in not only the music that is in front of you but also the process that came behind it and also the culture where it was produced, where it was produced and how the composer thought of that music, what's their process, their inspiration. You gotta go deep in research. That's why I'm fortunate that I am in a doctoral program, because there not only teaching you the rigors of really high level performing, violin performance, but also informed research, informed performances. Lastly, I remember this useful advice from the cellist of Brooklyn Rider. I forgot Michael something.
I forgot his last name, but he's awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome. And the repertoire choice came up one time in one of our coaching systems. And he said, at the end of the day, the music should sound good and to you that you really want to play it. So if you just play pieces because you just feel that, oh, I now need to play music that were written by BIPOC composers. Okay, let's just choose this, and we're done. No, you have to play music that you really like and you would advocate instead of you're just doing it out of necessity or out of social pressure.
That's so true. And that it begs the question, like, if you're not excited about what you're playing, at what point are you going to get burnt out? But also, like, if you have to just constantly play everything you play you don't like, and so therefore it doesn't make any difference if the music's good or not, or it's something that you enjoy, then, like, why play classical music? Mm-hmm. You know, I just feel like there's so much, I don't know, like, I love music as an art form and as a form of expression. And so I think getting to make music, especially with other people, is something unlike anything else. And, you know, you can tell as a group, like, when you're not enjoying something and when you are, and it's very different experiences. And I think that the audience can definitely feed off of that energy.
Definitely. Definitely. And also, in terms of, circling back to repertoire, a lot of people recognize now that the problem that classical music realm is facing, that we can't, like, we still go back to the canon, is because there's a lot of institutions, employers, that require the canon. And there was an article by Professor Gigi Kim about her student, she's a wonderful guitarist, and her student was frustrated because her student wants to play equally fulfilling works, but they're not from the canon. And they want to audition with that repertoire, but sadly, the student needs to learn standard rep, which, again, they are not really keen on doing.
Yeah.
So you're forcing something on a student that they don't like, but it's quite difficult to navigate that because it's so institutionalized.
Yeah.
It's there, and it's like a big iceberg.
Well, and I'm sure it matters, because what do you do if, like, you know, you're not allowed to play music that's written by someone from the same place as you or who looks like you? Like, that has to be such a huge dichotomy of, like, okay, I'm playing this music and I'm preparing it, but, like, you know, how do I fit into this if my music isn't being represented, or, like, music that's, you know, representative of my culture or my ideas from my culture aren't being represented? Like, I can see how that would be really, you know, stressful too. And, like, did you find that when you started finding these, like, works by Filipino composers in classical music, did you feel like that was a liberating experience, or, like,
I think it was more of a, not disappointment, but it's just sad that Filipino repertoire, like Filipino pieces composed by pieces composed by Filipinos. While they are being performed still around the world, they're not as much performed as pieces from the West. And that's why I made it a point in my dissertation topic, my project, is I am going to explore and learn about the development of Filipino modern art music, because I like contemporary repertoire, and that's something that wasn't looked extensively, specifically Filipino modern repertoire for violin. And so it will be a lecture recital of these two pieces by two renowned Filipino composers, and they're extremely difficult. Like when I finally got the score, I was like, Chino, what did you get yourself into? But it's going. It is going. But yeah, I want to be a champion and an advocate for Filipino art music, like classical music, and also Asian music. Because I've read extensively that composers from Asia during the 60s, 70s, 80s, while they were mostly, like a lot of them were schooled in the West, they wanted to have a distinct Asian style and ethos, pathos of composing and of music. So that's something I am looking at, and I'm proud to present it to the public, hopefully by November. I don't know.
That's so awesome. So, oh yeah, something I wanted to ask you, is music education different in the Philippines, or like in your experience between going to undergrad, I guess, in the Philippines versus your master's and doctorate, which I know are very different degrees anyway, but like
education, you mean post-secondary or in general?
I guess in general, just do you find that there is a different, any kind of different approach to music making, or maybe like what the demands are on music students versus here, or is it kind of the same?
In the Philippines, before college, music education before college is quite lacking. I don't know about now, but in my time during the 90s, 2000s, 21st century, it was severely lacking. We don't have orchestra programs within schools. It was mostly just private lessons, elementary music theory and secondary, like music theory and music appreciation in high school. I think it's just an equivalent of one or two semesters in your whole elementary and high school education. It's severely lacking. Back in my day, and back in the Philippines, there was competition, but we were such a small type community because we're so few. Most of the time we know each other by name, and that's kind of, I would say it's a little bit of a dangerous minefield to navigate, because everybody's so well connected or just connected that the rumors can get spread easily.
Sure.
Misunderstandings can blow up easily. And Filipinos are really passionate and emotional.
I feel like the music world is so small anyway, and it's like whenever you have a situation like that, it can definitely be like a pressure cooker.
Yeah, it's like, imagine the Philippines, it's a smaller pond with a lot of koi of various sizes. And then when I went to the United States, it's an ocean. It's a vast ocean. So, yeah, going back, college, interestingly, I had my undergrad in the University of the Philippines, and the University of the Philippines was a product of the American colonization. So the curriculum there, at least during my time, was similar to the curriculum here, but with lesser resources.
Wow, interesting.
So we had ear training, dictation, analysis, like the rudimentary stuff. But it's interesting because at least in my year, in my stay in the University of the Philippines, my music theory professors were European trained. So we didn't have the Roman numerals. I did not grow up with Roman numerals except letters. And it's a different kind of analysis. So when I went here and I saw Roman numerals, like, what the hell are they saying? And I, in my stay in the European training that I got in theory, they were more of looking at pieces in a more bigger picture, like probably Schenkerian, a bigger picture. So they really hate chord per chord labeling. It's more of chunks, sometimes chords, chord per chord, but it's more of a general bigger picture. And here it's a lot of vertical chord labeling.
That's so interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, it was a culture shock when I moved here.
Well, you had fixed dough, right?
You had fixed dough. I think I had pretty good start, but not enough that when I went to the States, I felt that I was behind. Yeah, but I had a lot of catching up to do, and I'm proud to say that I like who I am right now and as a violinist.
I think you're an amazing violinist, you know. Thank you. Awesome. I love playing music with you. Like,
same here.
Is so much fun.
Oh yeah.
So what made you decide that you wanted to study in the United States versus like Western Europe or anywhere else?
I decided to go to the United States. Well, I decided to go abroad first because I felt that the education that I had in the Philippines was something valuable, but I wanted more. Like, I think that I can grow more outside. So I did. And I like taking risks. So I did go and took the risk. And here I am, alive and kicking. And the reason why I went to the States and not Western Europe is because one language, the Philippines is one of like countries in Southeast Asia where English is really widely spoken. And sometimes, I wouldn't say indoctrinated, but it is so deep into the educational system. I think one benefit of it was when I took that English exam for admissions to the United States, I just aced it easily.
Nice.
But the other one is in Western Europe, I really wanted to study in Germany when I was younger, and I even took 1 year of German in undergrad. But then I found out that they have really strict standards that regardless of where you, at least the schools that I looked into, regardless of where you came from, you have to start your undergrad again.
What?
At least when, you know, when I was looking at requirements, and I was like, I don't want to start undergrad again.
That's a lot.
I know some of my previous teachers who went to Germany to live there and to work there. One even got an orchestra position. They said, yeah, we had to repeat our undergrad because they didn't recognize our diploma here in the Philippines.
Wow.
So it turned me off a little bit because it's kind of a
Yeah, I mean, why would you want to take extra 4 years or however long it's going to be just to...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And besides, I have a ton of family in the United States, so I went here.
That's nice. So the process was, you know, looking for schools, deciding you wanted to go somewhere overseas, going through the whole process of getting a student visa in the U.S.
Don't mention the finances. Ooh.
Yeah.
You have to prove a lot to go here. And then what's equally frustrating is, yeah, you have to prove a lot to go here, to study here, and then you're really limited.
Yeah. Yeah, like you said before, you know, like with job opportunities and what kinds of things you're allowed to do. And so I'm thinking, like, as a music teacher, if I'm working with a student that's an international student, like, just knowing the amount of struggle that you had to go through in order just to be in the US and be able to study, like, I don't know if you can answer this, but, like, are there some things that as a teacher would be helpful to, like, support international students that maybe we might not consider right off the bat?
I think being more aware of opportunities that international students could get. For example, if there are opportunities inside the campus for, I don't know, performance opportunities, work options inside the school, be actively advertise that to your international students if they want to apply, and also letting them know that being an international student is unique. It has its own unique problems, and you might not know, and you might not know them because you maybe didn't have experience in being an international student, but you're here to support and listen. What else? Also being aware of resources that international students could latch onto, like scholarships or private scholarships that could finance international students, or international nonprofits, or that could help international students in finances or opportunities, supporting them with, for example, competitions. Like, do you want to join a competition, an international competition? Every nationality is welcome. Do you want to join? I could help you. Yeah. Just be more proactive and not assuming that every person in your studio is in one box.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And being aware of resources and how you can refer people to resources too. Like, if you feel like you're not someone that can maybe necessarily help on your own. Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of, like, unknown resources out there too. Like, I know for you, like, having a violin, you know.
That's another problem, because I've come to a point that my violin is, like, I need a new violin. Not only for me, but for professional purposes, employment purposes. And it's... A violin, a good professional violin, will cost an arm and a leg. And I'm here as an international student. And my family is not rich. So how do I navigate that? That's another problem I'm looking at recently.
Oh, sorry to bring it up.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine.
I just remember what a huge benefit it was to have a really great violin to work on while you were... at ASU and while you're in the quartet. Like, it was just, it was such an awesome experience.
Yeah. I think. Yeah.
So being in the Diversity and Inclusion Committee, did that change your understanding of musicians' wellness, or, like, maybe what resources musicians might need that you weren't aware of before?
Definitely. I've learned through the student committee that there are specific resources that minorities need, minorities such as I and other people of color and the black community. They need specific resources. So it taught me how to be more sensitive to each student or each person that I will encounter, and not like assume that they just need support in their performances and their practicing and all that. You have to acknowledge that mental health is something really important for musicians, most especially minorities. They have, I don't want to say that we need it more than anyone else, but we have a set of unique problems that a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have that support system of being it at home with people you know, with all of your friends, like you're in a totally different environment. And so having that support as a resource, I think, is so important.
Also, what made me realize what the unique struggles of being minority is the trauma of seeing your own kind, your own people murdered, brutalized, attacked. Yeah. I'm Asian. So aside from being affected, of course, in a not as the Black community, I was affected with the murder of George Floyd and other Black people who were brutalized by the police. And on top of that was looking at Asians, and some of them were Filipinos, were attacked. Mental health is really crucial for every student, every musician, most probably to communities who are facing a lot of hardship. I also learned from the committee, from the student committee, is to be intersectional. I am actively learning and to be an anti-racist, and also I am learning how to be an ally to other communities outside my identity. And it's so touching and so refreshing to see Black, brown people like me banding together against racism, against violence, racial prejudice, racial injustice, instead of I'm just going to fight for my own.
Right.
I'm not going to care about the others. That's really not something that I want to see or I want to be, because that defeats the purpose. We're going to be divided. Instead, we need to band together for one cause. And we need to look out to each other, regardless if you're Black, if you're Asian, or if you're Latino. We need to band together and be allies to each other.
Yeah.
That's more powerful.
Absolutely.
We need to look out to each other. Look out for. I'm confusing my prepositions.
No, it's so true. And everything, it is a broader issue, but how we're able to feel like we can express ourselves and be interacting as musicians or as artists in the world and feel like we have that support and that we're safe to do so is very dependent upon feeling safe as a human in our society. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's like, it's generational and it's racial. And there's so many factors that go into it, but it's definitely an issue that has to be addressed in music schools too. It can't just be something that's overlooked. And so I really appreciate, you know, you talking about that and speaking on that, because I think that it's really important, and it's not something that we can ignore, you know?
Yeah.
And when we're talking about, I mean, I know, like, sorry to kind of like curve it back to musicians' wellness a little bit.
Of course.
But I think it's impossible to talk about wellness without including the intersectionality of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you're just going to talk about mindfulness and, for example, mindfulness without acknowledging that different sets of people, different people experience mindfulness and practice mindfulness in different ways. It's not your only, your way is the truth, is the truth. No. Right. And their ways of mindfulness is informed by their own experiences that you may not have. Yeah. I saw this, and I also see that you're also an advocate for that, like equity in the yoga community.
Oh yeah.
And I saw just a short clip of this woman who I assume is from India, and she was quite disappointed to see how yoga was presented as these mostly Caucasian, able-bodied, fit, lean people doing impossible poses with expensive gear.
Yeah.
With perfect powdered faces or something. And it's not that.
Well, and when you think about it, like, yoga at its core is one of these mindfulness practices. And there are other ancient mindfulness traditions, but to just slap the word mindfulness on it and be like, here it is, wrapped up in this neat little package that you can pay for. Yeah. Like, that's not you know, the point. It's like, how do we honor these ancient traditions and also respect that there are many differences in how we decide to engage with something like mindfulness?
That's true. And also, it became a capitalist venture.
Oh yeah.
Right, like branding and all that, and social media, how it just blew it out of proportion, took away from what yoga is from, which is from ancient, like, old Hindu tradition.
It predates Hinduism.
It's from
the Indus Valley region, and it was a civilization that predates Hinduism, predates Buddhism, like, predates a lot of things. But it's, I find it so interesting because it is like the birthplace of a lot of these ancient traditions. And that's not to say that, like, that was the only place that was happening, because I think I think mindfulness is as old as humanity. Like, it's kind of like, how can you define when it started?
You know what's, it reminded me of how recently some people are still close-minded with other ways of approaching mindfulness. You've heard or read or watched Marie Kondo, right?
Yeah.
So she has this way of things where if you are done with using that thing, you say thank you, you fold it neatly and respect it. You say thank you to the house or belongings, all that. A lot of people found it bonkers. Like, what the hell is she doing? Is this some crazy shit? And it's like,
no, this is very ancient practices.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but it reminds me of, it might be from Shintoism. Might be, I might be wrong. But that's another form of being mindful of your belongings, being mindful of your surroundings. It's just not in a way that you're used to.
Right.
So just because you're not used to seeing that doesn't mean that it's not legitimate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, I remember the first time I studied with a teacher who's half Japanese, and something that he brought up in a lesson with me was just like, what is your relationship like with your viola? Like, your viola has its own spirit. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I thought this was a music class. Like, I thought I was going to learn like how to, you know, interpret music, not like how to connect to the spirit and soul of my instrument as an inanimate object that has something very like, there's something sacred to it. Mm-hmm. Which I found very interesting. But yeah, it's like there's limitless ways that we can kind of interact with like mindfulness, or like just like how we come to understand each other, and then also acknowledging that there are many different ways to interpret the same thing, or different things that work for different people in terms of mental health, you know. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you being here, Gina.
Well, you know what, I really thank you for giving an international student platform to talk about my experience as an international student, because not a lot, I just sometimes feel that we're invisible. Mm. We're an invisible population. Sometimes disposable. Remember when Trump wanted to do something about the student visas?
Oh yeah.
And we couldn't do anything because we don't have any representation at all.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I hate this term, we're aliens. That's a legit term, immigration term. I'm an alien. that's how it was established. I can't do anything about it. But
yeah. I'm just honored that you took the time to be here with me today and to talk about this stuff. And before we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to share? Or maybe that any advice for our listeners?
Probably one motto that I learned from the Confoca podcast. You guys should listen if you're interested in classical music and issues of race and diversity in the classroom and in the concert stage. I think it was a podcast episode with Alfred Dworkin of Sphinx. And it was a short sentence, but impactful, that the arts need diversity to energize itself. Because without diversity, if we just play things and perform things, the old canon just repeat and regurgitate, we will be left behind. And that's something that a lot of the institutions want to make solutions for. Like, we think that we're being left behind. So what do? Diversify it, like open its doors, stop gatekeeping, stop gatekeeping what's good music and what's not good music, especially for people in power. You know, there's a lot of problems if you gatekeep too hard, and you have a narrow notion of what's good music and what's not good music. I mean, we need to widen our horizons. We need to finally let other people be on the table and let them speak and not speak for them. And that's something I valued while listening to that podcast. And also, I hope that institutions would finally realize that they need to change auditions, how they run auditions and what they expect in auditions. Maybe that's another podcast episode, entirely, but maybe on a different podcast, because that's more on like performance that, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tino. It's been so good to talk to you.
Thank you, Kim. Yes. Oh.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to hit subscribe, give us a rating, and follow on Instagram @thealignedmusician. Thank you so much and take care.